Okay.
I can feel in myself, I don't know how deep I feel. I've got this process, and it was sort of following imaginatively from black through the white. Possibly we'll see, we might have a bit of yellow or green, I don't know, there's all sorts of things can happen between the white and the red. But the three major stages are just really the black, the white and the red, but and there's all these intermediate possibilities like the bluing, which can happen both before and after the white. But anyway, I can feel in myself a reluctance to move on, you know. I don't really want to move away from the white at this point, personally. And we will, I'm sure. But I can feel that reluctance. So I did want to just say a little bit more, perhaps, about what this whitening might mean. And I'm very aware, actually, that whatever I say is going to be very partial, because it's a very rich I think perhaps the first thing to say is that it's the story's very interesting, because Mandava's right, it's a very, very alchemical story. The more I think about it, the more it follows the alchemical progress, whatever the word is. She's a maiden, isn't she? Originally, she's a maiden, she's a virgin, she's innocent, and so she's white. Yeah, she's pure, she's white. So this is the original innocence, the original state of innocence. Yeah. So this second whitening is quite different, yeah? It's not a return to this purity. It's a different kind of whitening. So it's a bit like, you know, songs of innocence and experience. It's a bit like she's no longer ignorant. I don't mean that in a judgmental way, but she has become worldly. She's no longer a virgin. She's got a child. And she's gone through these various trials, hasn't she? These various negrido, these dark nights of the soul. In her case, very strong, and it's not enough for her to go through it once somehow. It's not enough for her to get her hands severed. It's not enough for her to, you know, wander in the dark wood once. And she has this conjunction, she has this union, she gets married, but somehow actually she's still got to go back and into the negrido yet again. And this, of course, is often how it is for us. And this can be quite sort of shocking. If it's shocking, I remember when I got ordained actually. I had a lovely time getting there. I cycled from London to El Convento via Corsica. And I had quite a lot of time. Corsica, if you've ever been to Corsica, it's a very mountainous place. And you cycle around the perimeter of Corsica, then across the middle of it. And then, so we cycled right down to Marseille, got a ferry over to Corsica, cycled around Corsica, then got a ferry over to Italy and cycled up a bit of Italy to Tuscany, you know, and so I got there in a fabulous state, really, you know. And I had an absolutely pretty blissed out. I was pretty kind of blissed out for 4 months, really, basically, you know. And I thought, I suppose I didn't really even really think about it, but I thought, oh, well, this is how I am now. You know? this is me now. So anyway, yeah. A couple of days in Paris, then back to London, and you know, I was back in the. I wouldn't say I didn't actually get like terribly depressed or anything, but certainly I'd fallen from grace, you know. And it was a fantastic lesson, actually. It was a fantastic lesson because I was going to say, don't get fooled again, but of course we do get fooled again, but I'm a lot more aware of that tendency now. That tendency and not, you know, particularly when you, I think it's particularly prevalent when you engage two things, there's probably more than two things, but two things that I think it gets highlighted in is romantic encounters and spiritual endeavours. Both can be very deceptive in a sense. Yeah? Both feel, because they can be very strong, you know, very strong experiences, you're quite easily fooled into thinking that there's somehow, you know, somehow some fundamental change has happened, and then when you drop back into the negrito state, it's quite painful. It can be quite painful. This negrito state is characterized by a kind of over concern with the practical, actually. It's a sort of a grinding, slow dial where very often the mundane problems of the world, money, well, health, all these sort of mundane problems really get hold of you. And there's no... You know when people are in the negrito states, actually, because when you talk to them, every suggestion you make is just met with a no. No, I can't do that. No, that's not possible. No. And there's no, what's missing is the imagination. There's no kind of imaginative spark there. You can't quite engage the imagination because they're too earthed. The negrito state is this putrefied, earthed state, yeah? It's sort of necessary, perhaps, but actually something has to shift at some point. And what shifts is this movement into this whitening, you know, what we're calling the whitening or silvering. It's very often. It's interesting, the story gets these silver hands, so there's some freedom. She moves out of the negrito partially, it comes into the silver state, which allows her to engage in the world again. I mean, she falls in love, doesn't she? Gets married, you know, so it allows her to re-engage with vitality and the world in some ways, but she does drop back down into another negrito state. And this time she finds this, I was thinking about this house she finds in the woods, and there's something very open, because it's got this little sign, isn't it, saying anybody can live here. So it's totally kind of open, it's totally accepting. And some old lady there looking at, you know, in the white, there's a white lady there. In the white, whenever we get white, whether it's a white animal or a white lady, we know it's otherworldly, it's psyche manifesting, it's not literal. It's not to be taken literally. It's psyche manifesting, yeah. Like the animals, the white animals, they're guides to the soul. They're spirit guides, soul guides, yeah. They don't solve mundane problems. They don't tell us what to do with our investments. You know, they give us mad ideas. They introduce the imagination. So This whitening is a movement away from the mundane into a more imaginative grounding. So quite often it talks about as a white earth or the moon. The moon is quite interesting in Greek philosophy. When you die, you go to the moon, this is in some systems, so you go to the moon, you go to the dark side of the moon, and the soul in the, you lose all of your memory, and you're sort of purified in a certain sort of way. And then when you've undergone this purification process, you get re-embodied on a... So it's sort of like where souls go to be, sort of cleaned up in a way, the dark side of the moon. But anyway, you get this idea of this white earth, which is a sort of ground of the imagination, if you like. Ground of a particular type of imagination. Of course, this is very strongly associated with the moon and lunacy. Yeah? When people go mad, very often it's a proliferation and of imagination, isn't it? The imagination goes quite bonkers. This is sort of the archetypal mad person, you know. And the world becomes inhabited by other beings, by non-material entities, by forces, by weird coincidences and so on. So something happens, some real imaginative element comes in. Now obviously there's dangers in this, whitening, but there's also opportunities. So a meditative point of view, what I think this is trying to tell us is to not take things too literally when we're meditating, and to try and understand things. I'll use the word poetically, you know. I don't quite know, and we've been trying to do this with the body, because in a way the body tends towards negrito, yeah? It tends towards the literalism, and we become very literal. Actually, I think in our culture now we're very literal about the body very often, insofar as we've more or less sucked out all psyche from body. You see, psyche is somehow completely separate from body. So our model now, isn't it? I remember when my son was at primary school, and he had some book, I can't remember what it was, and it was talking about the human being, and the analogy it gave, I found it appalling. It talks about the body as a machine, and the brain as a computer. I thought, what a bloody analogy, but what is this, you know? Anyway, and I think that's very common, you know, this idea. And it's very interesting now, isn't it, in gyms, where actually they're more and more about these quite complicated machines, aren't they? You get on these quite complicated machines, and you become the motor for these machines, don't you? I mean, it's very, you know, it's quite an interesting thing where, I mean, there's plenty of other ways you could get exercise. We get exercise in a way that we treat the body more and more as if it's a mechanical, just purely mechanical thing. We look after it, we give it the right fuel, blah, blah, blah. But actually, we don't often spend time just being attentive to it, talking to it, having a relationship with it, you know, having a sort of tenderness with it, a kindness towards it, allowing the imagination into the body, you know. And then when things start going wrong, we just want to fix them. Of course we want to fix them, that's quite natural. But sometimes we can't fix them. And then then you're left with nothing, can't you? You're left with no meaning at all. If they're purely mechanical and they go wrong, then they're just useless. Yeah, you just throw. You know, if you've got a bit of machinery at home and it doesn't work anymore, you throw it out, don't you? If you've got something that you love at home, maybe it's no longer, you know, something that you actually love, you keep it, don't you? Even though it might be a bit scratched or broken or not quite work properly anymore. But you love it, you keep it. And you do your best to kind of care for it and come into relationship with it. And it evokes a sense of sympathy and care in you, rather than, that's a bit of crap, I'll throw that out, you know. And I don't think it's so different. So when we start, and I mean, maybe this is also true psychically, not only physically, but psychically. Now, there's bits of us we don't like, we find annoying because they're not quite our image of how we should be, you know. And so we sort of shove them away, we try and shove them down into the darkest recesses of our being. Put them away in some cupboard or something, you know, internally, and hope that they never get come out. And then we come on a retreat like this, we come here, and actually, what you're really being invited to do, isn't it, is to open these drawers and actually start looking at this stuff that you shoved away, and thinking, well, what has this got for me? What meaning has this got for me? Why is this here? What can I do with this? How can I turn towards this in a different way? And our turning towards it in a different way is always an act of imagination. Yeah? So meditation, I mean, this might sound quite contradictory to people, because on the one hand, I'm saying to you, as the days go by, I hope you're hearing it, I'm saying, well, it's all about the posture. That's all it's about. But on the other hand, I'm saying to you, it's all about the imagination. So I'm asking you somehow to find a way of bringing those two things together. So I don't want you to have a literal relationship with your body, your posture. I want you to have an imaginative one. Yeah? So I can't, you know, in a way, the way of imagining what you're doing is vital. What we don't often quite understand is that our whole perception of the world is based in imagination. You know, we have this sort of scientific idea that we've got this sort of data coming in, we've got this computer brain, and it makes sense, it makes some kind of objective sense of this data, and then sort of tells our body what to do. I don't know what our model is, you know. But of course it isn't like that at all, is it? The way we experience the world is through the imagination. And what we make of the world, what we make of our lives, is an imaginative endeavour. Yeah. The thing that, the two things that most cripple people's lives, I think, is a lack of imagination and a lack of courage. You know, sometimes they go together and sometimes they don't. So you need the heart, and it is interesting to me that the heart is the seat of, traditionally speaking, the seat of the imagination, and it's also the seat of courage. You know? So it's the heart that gives us both imaginative capacity, that we open the heart. In the traditional way of looking things, particularly in the Sufi tradition, but not only in the Sufi tradition, you get it in Buddhism, you get it in Christianity as well, actually. You know, there's an idea that the heart receives things. It's a perceptual organ of imagination, and this imaginative world, this world of the white animal, this world of psyche, it does exist externally from us. This is quite a difficult thing to take on, because obviously, probably most of us, being quite materialistic, we can't quite take it on literally, but we don't have to take it on literally. Actually, it's not a difficult thing to understand, because It's the basis on which all art works, isn't it? If you go and see, I remember being in New York where they had a major retrospective of Rothko, you know, and you're looking at those paintings, and you spend a bit of time with those paintings, you know, they start to have this huge effect on you, you know. What's going on there? What's going on there? Something kind of mysterious is going on there, isn't there? There are these sort of fields of colour that somehow start to have this tremendous emotional depth and resonance with you, know? I mean, maybe Rothko doesn't do it for you, but whoever it is that does it for you, you know, whether it's music, whether it's the visual arts, whether it's nature, we all know what it is to open up the heart or to come to something open-hearted or to come to something closed. We come to something with the heart when the heart's shut down. Nothing touches us, does it? Nothing comes in. We come to something with the heart open because we're hugely affected by the world. It ignites our imagination. There's something out there and it comes in and it ignites us. You know? So this is what's sort of meant by imagination, really. It's the ability to allow the world to ignite you in a way, to be ignited. And in a way, this is the work we're trying to do in meditation. We're trying to abide with the body in such a way that we're bringing it back to life, if this isn't too strong. And we all have degrees of numbness. Some of us are more numb than others, you know. Some of us are, you know, quite open. We all go through phases, but, you know. And when I'm talking about attending or abiding to the body with kindness, what we're really trying to do is to bring back feeling, psyche, imagination into the body. We're trying to make ourselves receptive once more. You know, we had that. E. E. Cummings always puts these things so beautifully. And when we had that one earlier, didn't it? My heart always be open to little birds. Whatever they sing is best for them to know. And then the second verse, it says, may my mind roam about. My mind roam about fearless and thirsty. Yeah, fearless. Yeah. So again, we've got this coupling of courage and imagination and beauty. So this might not be the normal way we think about of what we're trying to do as meditators. And of course, it's just one possibility. But I would encourage you here to think about this, and consider this as one way of understanding what you're trying to do with meditating. And the courage of a meditator in this sense is just to turn fully towards what's there. Fully towards what's there. Yeah. And if what's there is a sense of despair or loneliness or joy or whatever it is, we just turn towards it and we try and turn towards it as fully as possible without willful forcing, because this is something different. This is something different. This turning towards is a tenderness. It's a tenderness, yeah. It's not wanting to get rid of something. This is often where we find ourselves in a problem as meditators. Very, very often, actually, our methodology is aversion, and we don't really realise it. We're distracted, and we want to get rid of the distraction. So what we've got there is a distraction, and what we put on top of it is aversion. So this is quite subtle and quite difficult to way of working, because we need to be able to turn towards this material without actually wanting to get rid of it. And of course we want to get rid of it if it's unpleasant, yeah. Of course we do. So we're working difficult. You won't get it right. You won't get it right. But it's kind of all right. You just approximate. You do your best. You don't get it right. It's like light, you know. The Dogen, who was the established Zen in Japan, has got this little phrase, I don't know, it gets translated as the spiritual life is one continuous mistake. I just love that. Mm-hmm. So we're not going to get it right. We might have some fantasy that one day we're going to, you know. We might have some redemptive fantasy. Actually, enlightenment isn't, I don't think, a redemptive fantasy. We're kind of confused if we think we're going to get enlightened and everything's going to be all right. We're getting Buddhism confused with Christianity. Buddhism isn't a redemptive fantasy. But it is saying you can come into a more intimate, a more compassionate relationship with what it means to be in this world. Yeah. It is saying that. And it is possible that the process of doing that will be one continuous mistake. So you've got to kind of somewhere drop the idea that you're getting it right or wrong and actually just be more and more interested in what's really going on. This is the only way, really. It's just somehow, and it's very, very difficult when you've got material that you're really sick of or you find really uncomfortable. But what we're trying to do is just have an attitude of tender interest and trust in that somehow. Trust that something comes out of that, something of worth, something of meaning, something of depth comes out of that kind of tender interest that we can have. And this is why it all links up. The main way we've got to do this is by finding a posture that expresses love. Our posture needs to express our intention. The main way of expressing ourselves is like everything else. When we go out and walk up the field there and we see an oak tree in the middle of the field, it's just expressing itself, isn't it? Through what it is. Boom, there it is. No, you know what that is. It knows what it is. It's just the same for you. When you sit, Suzuki of Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind fame, you know, one of his little essays in that book, he's talking about to sit is to just completely express yourself. It's quite a difficult thing for us to understand what he's talking about. But he's right, yeah? To sit is to completely express yourself. We think of expressing ourselves, we've got to get up and do a little dance or you know, do something, you know. But actually, just to sit quietly, that's you. It's your completely expressing yourself, just as that rock or that tree or that flower is expressing itself. We're just completely expressing ourselves. And so this is why how you sit is of vital importance. Yeah? If you sit all, well, I needn't go into it, you know, because you've got to find in your own way, within the limitations of your body, because this has got to go on until you're, let's hope you're all going to live to you like, you know, 90, 100 and still be meditating. And you're not going to probably be able to have really good-looking postures by then, you know, all bent over and half British. and it's all going to be very difficult. But actually, you can still sit in a way that expresses your beauty. Yeah? You know, anybody that's been on retreat with me many times would have heard this story. It's one of my favourite stories of this. I'm just very short in the night. And when Lorca, poet Lorca, the playwright Lorca, goes to a flamenco competition, dance competition, and he talks about all these beautiful, water-wasted young women coming on stage and doing these fantastic dances, you know. And then he talks that right at the end, some old hag comes on the stage, stamps her foot and throws her hand in the air, and she wins the competition. Because she had what they call a duende, you know, the spirit of Spain, the spirit of a dance. Which is quite, it's a bit like that fairy story, that spirit, because it's quite dark spirit. It's not just the light, it's also the sort of blood of and the earth, and you know that Spanish thing, you know, you get a sort of taste of it, can't you? You know, the hot sun and the dry earth and the blood and the bullfighting. Anyway, it has this particular spirit. It expresses fully something. And so we need, if we can, when we sit, let your posture express you fully, whatever that means to you. This is a mysterious thing that you're going to have to... I was going to say work out. You don't really have to work it out. You just got to let it happen. Yeah? It can happen. It will happen. It can happen. It does happen. And you know when it's happening. You kind of know when it isn't happening. And this is the same in life, of course, isn't it? It's a strange thing, isn't it, in life. We know when we're moving towards ourselves and moving away from ourselves, if you know what I mean. We know when we're acting more or less from some core, authentic part of ourselves, and we know when we're not. And perhaps you could say, all we're trying to do in meditation is get better at knowing that, you know, and braver at being able to access that part of ourselves. Yeah, access that part of ourselves. And act and express and be from that part of ourselves. Anyway. Okay, I will leave it there. So that inevitably involves the imagination, because it's an imaginative act to be alive, you know, a poetic act. We're all involved in this poetic act. You know. I believe, and I don't even know what I mean by this, but it's that psyche or reality, I'll go as far as to say that reality is basically poetic. You know. Reality is basically poetic. So when we're talking about, Buddhism quite often talks about, you know, align in yourself, you know. What's the phrase? It's got some phrase it uses, isn't it? What is it? Come on. There's some Buddhists here, come on. What does it say? It says about... I can't remember what it is. Isn't it? Seeing things as they really are, isn't it? Yeah, seeing things as they really are. Well, things are really poetic, yeah. Bodies aren't really machines. That's not seeing things as they are. Things are really full of imagination. Think of poetic. So to align yourself with reality is to step into a poetic way of understanding the world. Find your own word, but hopefully you've got some sense. You know when you feel most alive, don't you? And when you feel most alive, that's reality, yeah.